Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Markets, and I am your guest host, Chris Opperman, sitting in for Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is Unbreakable Union, Lessons from the Demise of the Soviet Union. And our guest is Dr. Yuri Maltsev. Welcome, Dr. Maltsev.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be with you.
Dr. Maltsev is a native of the Soviet Union and received his MA in History and Social Science at Moscow State University and his PhD in Economics at the Institute for Labor Research in Moscow. Dr. Maltsev has an impressive publishing record, which consists of 5 monographs, contributions to 16 books, and dozens of articles, including co-authored materials in various languages. And Dr. Maltsev currently serves as a professor at Carthage College in Wisconsin and your senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn. Dr. Maltsev, today we would like to talk about a recent paper of yours, which was delivered by our regular host, Michael McKay, at the Mises Institute's Austrian Scholars Conference in March. The paper was called Unbreakable Union, Lessons from the Demise of the Soviet Union. And today we want to talk about the rise and the fall of the Soviet Union in Russia and what this means for the situation and crisis facing the United States today. So one of the things that you point out right at the start of your paper is the great irony in the title, Unbreakable Union. And you point out, in fact, that this was the first line of the state anthem of the Soviet Union.
That's right. Yes, it was. Nobody could predict that this such a speedy demise of the evil empire. Not people in the CIA, definitely. No other Western analysts would predict that Soviet socialism would not work. But that was Ludwig von Mises who predicted that system is not a viable system. That it's not an economic system even. It's just a simple system of management, simple system of coercion and mass murder. He wrote about that in his wonderful essay, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, which was published half a year after the Bolshevik Revolution in St. Petersburg and Moscow.
Yeah. Well, and that's the interesting thing that, at the time, Mises was one of the few economists that was really coming forward with this idea that state central planning wouldn't work. And, if you look at other aspects of the Soviet Union, there are certain, things that would make it a very powerful empire. And nevertheless, the Soviet Union managed to fail despite many things that may have been working in its favor.
Well, the more free market economy is destroyed, the more statism you have, the bigger is the government and the role of government in society. Then the more coercion, the more deprivation people of choices you should apply to that society, and that's exactly what happened. And I think that to study this is very important. Von Mises wrote that if we wish to save the world from barbarism, we have to refute socialism. We cannot thrust it carelessly aside. And that's exactly what many people are trying to do. They're saying, well, these lessons are applicable only to Soviet Union or to communist China, but this is not what we're experiencing in the United States. However, here we see the just an enormous increase in the functions and the scope of government. And Armen Alkian, a very famous economist from University of California in Los Angeles, he wrote that any government is socialism, and the only thing is to keep it small, to keep it in check. And the more government you have, the more socialism you have. And so, say, in the Soviet Union, they had government running everything. Even a shoeshine stand operator was a government employee. So everybody, 99.99% of people worked for the government. And look what happened.
Very good. Well, Dr. Maltsev, again, thank you very much for being on the show. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back after the break. Again, this is Chris Opperman sitting in for Michael McKay, interviewing Yuri Maltsev. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Chris Opperman on Radio Free Markets, and we are interviewing Dr. Yuri Maltsev on lessons learned from the demise of the Soviet Union. Dr. Maltsev, we've been talking a little bit about your paper on the Soviet Union and the failures of the Soviet Union and some of the fundamental failings in the structure of communism that were pointed out by Ludwig von Mises many years ago. One of the lessons related to that you point out in your paper is that real property rights matter. Many of our listeners know that the existence of property rights is the foundation of any functioning economy and a free society. But it's very easy to say that, oh yes, private property exists here in this economy or it doesn't there, but in particular, we need the existence of real property rights. So Dr. Maltsev, in your opinion, what does it mean to have a real substantial property rights in a society?
Well, by true property rights, the meaning of that is that you have a right to acquire, use, develop, profit from, or dispose of your property as you see fit. In the Soviet Union, property rights, due to Marxism-Leninism, were condemned as a tool of exploitation of one person by another. In the United States, we also see the process of erosion of property rights. Now, property rights are so regulated by the state, undermined already, that we are moving towards a fascist economy. And fascism is a form of socialism where you have nominally property rights, but de facto, in reality, you don't have any property rights.
And that's an important point to make. One of the things that you point out in your paper is that a lot of the Soviet leaders in the early days try to make a great distinction between the Soviet Union and other fascist countries like Germany or Italy, claiming that the Soviet Union was, you know, far left and the Nazis were far right. And, you know, this left-right distinction is something that we're stuck with today. But, you know, when you look at it at the end of the day, both sides, both of these left and right sides, both engage in the same denial of freedom and the same denial of basic property rights.
That's right. And also, I would say it's erroneously to call, say, fascist right, because fascists were just, it was a form of socialism called National Socialism, and they were declared right by Stalin, who spoke at the 7th Congress of the Comintern in 1935. Before that, everybody thought of socialism and fascism as being two branches of the same movement. And in 1935, Stalin decided that it's better for them to disassociate themselves with fascists, and so he declared them extreme right. And they were not extreme right, because right, in common understanding, that would be associated with individualism, with private property rights, with a free banking, with a freedom in all other spheres of human life. And definitely nor fascists nor socialists in the Soviet Union would not share this belief. So that's why I think that we should call things what they are. I think Confucius once said that when words would lose their meaning, people would lose their liberty. And that's exactly what's happening. We also see not only undermining of property rights, but undermining of our language, undermining of our culture. And I think this is very important for us to keep in mind that property rights is the basis of free society. And you were absolutely right that you emphasized that property rights is a backbone of freedom. It's very, very important. You cannot have a market economy without property rights. Nobody can sell and buy stolen property. So property rights is also extremely important for the rule of law. Without property rights, there is no rule of law. So it is extremely, I think, important to keep in mind that property rights is the system of free exchange, of freedom in free society.
And you rightly point out, this tendency when governments attempt to seize power, to undermine liberty, their tendency to try to undermine the real meaning of language. Because one of the things that you do point out is that in the German and Italian societies, you know, there was at least nominally private property or was somewhat tolerated. But nevertheless, you still had property that was seized and directed and controlled by the state, even though it was nominally private.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And we see more of the same happening here, or even in Russia, to that matter. That we see this worldwide, I would say, kind of movement towards fascist economy, because government is getting bigger and bigger almost everywhere, and we see this this assault on not only on property rights but on a lot of human rights, because they come together with property rights. James Madison called property rights mother of all rights, and definitely we should keep in mind that it's not just property rights; it's all other human rights will go down the drain. And this is extremely important.
Well, and now that we're already talking about the existence or the absence of property rights in the Soviet state, one of the things that's also important to point out is that the Soviet state wasn't the first state in Russia to really deny effectively real property rights. I mean, you point out that this was a long-standing tradition in a different way under the bureaucratic state of the Tsarist government.
That's right. Any autocracy would be undermining property rights in the sense that, for example, in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, property rights nominally were declared in the constitution. How can you exercise your rights if you don't know whether you'll be alive tomorrow or not? So people would not have plans. They would have a culture of immediate gratification, because that's what you need. If you don't know how durable you are yourself, then you definitely want to consume everything right away, and you don't invest in your future, because your future is uncertain and in many cases very bleak. And so that's and then when you don't have property rights, and if you are a ruler, then you should apply mass murder, which was applied in all socialist countries, including Iraq, which was and still is actually a socialist country, like many other Arab states.
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, you can see that in other states like Egypt and Syria and Libya, and this is really a paradigm that that transcends across the Arab world.
Right, because I was just with Michael McKay. We were in Turkey and attended a wonderful conference of Property and Freedom Society in Bodrum, Turkey. And look how difficult it is for Turkey to deal with this unruly neighbors, for the socialist Syria, for example, because what they do right now, they are murdering people because they don't have any other incentives to modify human behavior. For example, in a free society, in a peaceful society, you are enjoying the fruits of your labor. You have a lot of incentives to work hard and to leave something for your children. But if the government steps in and destroys these property rights, then people usually respond by not working. In Soviet Union, they used to say they pretend they're paying us and we pretend we're working for them. And that was the pretty kind of bad kind of thing. And so in all spheres, can you imagine if there's pretenders are in healthcare or in other vital industries, so you don't have that as well. I mean, if you have doctors or nurses who are extorting bribes, in many cases, for example, it's a very gruesome statistic, 78% of all people who are HIV positive in the Soviet Union got the AIDS virus from dirty needles and tainted blood from the state-run hospitals, and they got it for free. And we have a lot of people in the United States who are embracing free healthcare, thinking that it's free. No, it is not free. And I would say that the last thing we should tinker with is with our bodies, with our own health, because the first bastion of private property is your own body. You should own yourself, otherwise somebody else owns yourself. The state owns yourself, so you become a slave of the state. And that's why I think that the most appalling of all happening, since the socialist takeover of Washington D.C. is the nationalization of healthcare.
Well, and that's precisely the point. One of the things you repeatedly emphasize is that these aren't just lessons for the Soviet Union. These are things that our own government is doing in a very subtle way. when you were talking about the disincentive to work and the erosion of savings and thinking of the future less and less, that's something that the government here does all the time with inflation, when it destroys the value of our currency and disincentivizes us to save.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, yes, there is a kind of a school of thought in the United States and other Western countries which are trying to disassociate communism in the Soviet Union with socialism of their own making. They would say, well, communism was bad, but socialism is pretty good. And the socialists, however, they forget that there is no such thing as communism. Communism was this secular religion created by Karl Marx, out of which socialism would be the first stage. And this first stage would last for 400 to 500 years. So communism was never achieved anywhere in the world. It according to Marx, it would be maybe attained in 400 or 500 years. Socialism never worked, and socialists, that's how you need to do it. You need to undermine currency, because without free currency, you don't have freedom. I mean, then you can be manipulated by the state and do whatever. So your incentives to work, your incentives to keep property, if this property is not reflected in any valuable currency, then you are eroding property rights this way. So it is. Then many people would say, well, look, Russians could not even produce a car with automatic transmission, so we know better how to make socialism work. And no, like that, saying that this is not a systemic failure of socialism, but this is kind of a cultural issue with, say, Russian people or Chinese people, that we in the West, we know how to deal with that. And many people thinking that, well, the major tool for that would be, say, environmentalism or whatever else. However, if you will look at Germans who practice socialism in the GDR, in the German Democratic Republic, another country which you cannot find on the map today, the Germans could make almost everything work or anything work, and they were miserable, and GDR was a miserable failure in comparison with any market economy. So 35 countries staged this deadly experiment with socialism on themselves. None of them succeeded, and we think that that's not enough evidence that socialism works. We should try it again. I saw recently in Texas a wonderful T-shirt.
Dr. Malkin, we have to cut to break, but
okay.
Please hold that thought and we'll be right back. This is Radio Free Market. We'll be right back. Please stay with us, everybody. Welcome back, everybody. This is Radio Free Markets, and I'm your guest host, Chris Opperman, sitting in for Michael McKay. We're picking up a conversation with Dr. Yuri Maltsev on lessons from the Soviet Union. And when we went to break, we were talking about this failed experiment that was socialism and this failed distinction in 35 different countries to try to create a distinction between state socialism and this scary communism that nobody wanted. So Dr. Maltsev was talking a little bit more about how industry and production and life function in the Soviet Union. Dr. Maltsev, would you like to continue your thoughts?
Yes, I think that was we were blessed by some historical kind of experiments conducted on different nations. To learn from this, if we want to learn anything, that if you will look at this divided during the Cold War, divided countries like North Korea and South Korea, like East Germany and West Germany, South Vietnam and North Vietnam, like Hong Kong and China and Taiwan. You would see that the evidence of history is unequivocal. I mean, history is telling us in a single voice that socialism never worked. That you can see a lot of mass murder and misery and in the Soviet Union itself, anywhere from 40 to 60 million people died in Gulag in the system of the concentration camps created by socialists. Why would they apply mass murder so generously to their people? Because they created systems of public slavery. Nobody cared about slaves, and to make slaves work, the only thing is to apply coercion towards them, to apply violence. In the People's Republic of China, for example, recently came out that the human toll of cultural revolution, of one episode of their sad history, was 45 million people who were starved to death or killed by their own socialist leaders, like Mao Zedong and others. So it is everywhere. You see socialism, you need to understand that it cannot survive without mass murder. It cannot survive without violence. It cannot survive without coercing people to do what the leaders want. Because
this is a point that you brought out a few months ago when Glenn Beck had you on his program. And one of the books that you talked about was The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich Hayek, one of the famous proponents of Austrian or reality economics. And he and Milton Friedman often would argue that you can't have political liberty, you can't have a free society if the government is controlling the economy, if the government is coercing and conducting and centralizing everything in the economy.
Absolutely, absolutely, because I would say that the freedom without property rights is a socialist slogan. You never can have freedom without that. And if the government controls the economy, government controls everything else. And we already see in the United States the attempts by the big government to control your health, to control energy, to control banking and all financial system. And so that's now it's just going after industries like automobile industry and others. So it's definitely we are moving into that direction, and that's why I think that we should learn lessons from the demise of the Soviet Union.
One of the economists that you mentioned previously was Ludwig von Mises, another proponent of Austrian economics, who predicted that the only way that a socialist economy could ever really hope to produce resources was through rationing. And, you know, what are some of the examples of Soviet rationing that can really show us how terrible of an idea this is?
Yes. Well, if you don't have property rights and then the government takes over the economy, then the government needs to be engaged in central planning and something called central planning. And central planning is the greatest experiment in futility in the history of human race, because then you need to plan everything for everybody. And so you don't know how to plan, for example, how could you know how to plan, I don't know, supply of the heart medicine for the people in Chelyabinsk in the year 2025? I mean, and then how many units of housing should be built for teachers who would teach these people something? So was an academician, Nikolai Fedorenko, in the Soviet Union, who was one of the first econometricians in the Soviet Union, and he was extremely frustrated by the centrally planned system. He made some calculations that you would need about 30,000 years of computer time to create more or less reliable plan. I would say that he was wrong, that you never can create reliable plan even with a million years of computer plan, but even he, who was a central planner himself, he was to admit that central planning would not work. However, most socialists do not understand that or don't want to understand that. Even Gorbachev, when he was elected general secretary of the Communist Party, well, elected by 11 people, Politburo members, even he used to say that planning is a good system, that the only problem that we never had a good plan. But then you need to ration everything as well, because if you're planning something and somebody wants more or less of what you're planning, then you need to kind of either adjust your plan, which is impossible, or adjust this person. And that's what exactly they were doing. You could only consume as much as was produced, and produced was less and less and less because there were less and less incentives to work. And when under Gorbachev they removed fear out of the system, which was based only by fear, then the whole thing collapsed in completely unpredictable for anyone except Soviets themselves way. Yeah, so this is very important. Hear the same thing.
Dr. Maltsev. Well, we're going to go again to break, but we'll be right back. Everyone, this is Radio Free Market. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. This is Radio Free Market, and we're interviewing Dr. Yuri Maltsev on lessons about the Soviet Union. Before we went to break, Dr. Maltsev was talking about the end years of the Soviet Union. when programs of reform and lessening of political oppression led to the demise of the evil empire. And one of the reasons, Dr. Maltsev, why you point out that this occurred was because a system of economic central planning and political control can only really be motivated by coercion and fear, because people, free people, don't want this sort of system.
Absolutely. And I think that we should credit Mikhail Gorbachev with his perestroika policy, because what he did, maybe inadvertently, that he removed fear out of the system glued only by fear. And he removed it by all the time talking about something he could call human face of socialism. We kind of couldn't understand what he meant by that, but people thought that nobody would be killed anymore and stopped working. And at that time, I think we had a kind of a pretty funny joke that the CIA sent their best agent to Moscow to find out what perestroika and Gorbachev is about. And he was walking from one empty store to another with his notebook, and he would go to a bakery and would write in his little notes, he would write no bread. He would go to the butcher shop, no meat, to the shoe store, no shoes, and there was a KGB guy looking over his shoulder, and he said, well, 10 years ago you would be killed for doing that. And the CIA guy writes there, no bullets. And then when people realized that there are no bullets anymore, then everybody stopped working. People just would go to work to steal something, or to steal working time, or to do puzzle words or whatever. So that was the collapse of Soviet Union. And then what's interesting, that nobody had a stake in that kind of society. If you remember, it was bloodless. No violence, because everybody was sick and tired of socialism. Here, socialism is presented as a glorious future, and under different guises of social justice or of environmental issues, global warming or whatever else. But if you would look into what actually is offered is for you to lose your freedom. And that's under different pretenses. I'm not saying that we don't have environmental issues. We do. But look what the so-called environmentalists are offering us is to throw out property rights. And with property rights, all other rights would be gone. And people don't realize that. Or wars all around the globe. We're getting from one war to another. I don't think we had any peaceful periods in our recent history. We're all the time engaged somewhere and making more and more enemies of the United States all over the world.
That's something that intrigues me about your joke, about there being no bullets left. Because, you know, the Soviet Union certainly did invest in a lot of military capability. It was, you know, the second superpower after the United States, and it had a lot of nuclear weapons and went to go fight wars in Afghanistan and such. You know, having lived in the Soviet Union, how did war affect the reduction of liberty, or how did war affect the reduction of economic liberties?
Well, I would say war is the negation of liberty everywhere. I mean, the more you have a war economy, the less you have everything else, the more you have people who are interested in wars, and war is nothing but breaking things and killing people. And in the Soviet Union, that was a not only perfect killer state, but it was a perfect mobilization state, because they had enemies all over the world. I mean, they would if they wouldn't, they would create enemies. Look, even today's Russia is kind of pretty obstinate and trying to play the role of the superpower, which they cannot, by making enemies mostly. By attacking everybody. And so, like Georgia, for example, other former Soviet republics are very fearful of the Putin's regime in Moscow. So this is a problem with all wars. And in the United States, definitely, these wars, I mean, they lead to reduction of all liberties and reduction in property rights, the same thing. And reduction is justified in many cases by wars. I mean, look at the Patriot Act or many other attempts to reduce our freedom.
Yes, and as you point out, I mean, you know, these are things that would never have you know, occurred to people that would be, you know, possible in a country that supposedly is as free as America. Things like the Patriot Act give the government power to tap into people's phones, to read their emails, and now the government is claiming to be able to assassinate people and to be able to hold them indefinitely in a prison forever. That sounds like it's something out of the Gulag, right? I mean, isn't that something that was practiced in the Soviet Union?
Yes, absolutely. And you can see that the same methods are already used for even non-terrorist activities. I mean, look, there's a series of indictments of these financial operators because their emails and their phones were tapped and kind of in a very casual way. So war is socialism. War is socialism. War is war creates a bigger state. Yeah. So that's why I think that we definitely need to keep that in mind that war is incompatible with freedom. There are some definitely wars which could be justified. Somebody would attack the United States and would not. But that's one of the functions of government, of for which von Mises and Hayek were saying that this is a legitimate function of government. But from another hand, we should keep in mind that we cannot straighten up the whole world and sending to our troops to promote some kind of social work programs in various countries which are not willing to accept this that's ridiculous. I mean, like promoting Planned Parenthood overseas and all these kind of things. Many cultures revolt against this.
And much in the same way that the government tries today to sort of hide the pernicious and evil effects of domestic socialism, in many ways the government also tries to do the same thing with the costs of war. You know, when World War II was fought or World War I was fought, there was a lot of overt domestic control at home. There was a lot of rationing. There was a lot of government propaganda. There was a lot of control. And those things still exist, but they happen in a much more subtle and much more secret way.
Absolutely. And you can see that a lot of problems, a lot of this ticking bombs were planted during that year. For example, now we have this healthcare crisis. I mean, and it is real. I mean, that healthcare system is not a market system anymore already, with government taking 55% of all costs, rationing care and doing all kind of things. But the foundation for that was laid because of the price and wage controls during the Second World War. Then the employers began to offer health care insurance to attract productive workers. So and then definitely health care system, if nationalized by government, would be a step in the very wrong direction, in the direction of losing whatever remnants of freedom we have, because then you wouldn't own your body and the government would ration health care, because otherwise you cannot have it. I mean, it's just impossible to provide free health care for all without
and the healthcare rationing. And the healthcare example, I think, is very interesting because that statistic that you put out, that the government takes care of more than 50% of all healthcare costs. And I think that this is an enlightening example of how the state propaganda machine works. Because when the healthcare debate happened in this country, the idea that was promoted by the government was that the healthcare system was an example of why free market systems don't work. But yet you have an industry where the government pays for more than half of the costs. And that's not a free market industry. That's just government propaganda at work.
Absolutely, and this is. And if you will look at how they teach economic history, the same thing. For example, Great Depression. It's all time presented that free market didn't work, and so the free market screwed up the American economy, and that's what happened. We have a lot of evidence to the contrary that it was the Federal Reserve and the Hoover administration who made these egregious mistakes in. But it's impossible actually to rule the economy from one center effectively. So they couldn't, and we had Great Depression. Today we have the same thing, that many people would think, well, free markets screwed up our healthcare system, and so we need to replace it with outright socialism. And the public, so-called public option, is socialism, nothing else. And then if you would do that, you're creating more problems, and you for which, as Hayek would say, you need even more government to solve. And definitely, as I kind of was speaking recently in a place called Sherman, Texas, and one lady said, "Well, you are like Sarah Palin. You came here to scare us." I said, "Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I want to do. I think that we should be scared, and I wish somebody would come and scare Russians in 1917, or Chinese in 1948, or Cubans in 1959. Then so many unnecessary deaths of millions of innocent people could be prevented."
It's better to be scared by an economist than by the government, right?
So. Absolutely. Well, I mean, that it's because it's such a thick, I would say, the government propaganda, socialist propaganda, especially flown by the government radio and government TV stations like NPR or National Propaganda Radio or PBS. These stations, right? It's nothing else but propaganda of a big government.
Well, and that's an interesting thing because as the government gets more and more involved in this in political and in matters and education matters and communication matters, you see this creation almost of a separate class. Mm-hmm. In your paper, you talk a bit about the effect of the degeneration of the rule of law. And it's this kind of, you know, we see this when a political scandal in America happens, for example, when politicians think that they shouldn't be arrested because, you know, oh, I'm a senator or I'm a representative. And I think that is a symptom of a decline in a society when it's thought that the government suddenly grants to somebody a sacrosanct status, a status that they are a superior being because they are a member of the controlling class, of the ruling class.
Very much so. I came to the United States already 22 years ago, and I would say this country changed so much that today it's almost impossible to get into the halls of Congress. Because they built a visitor center, so you can go in visitor center. It's kind of a museum of the worship of the big state, but you cannot go to the congressman. You cannot do a lot of other things. I remember anyone could come to the Library of Congress and read whatever they like to do to read. Now you need special letters. You need to prove that you really need that, and that's amazing. By the people who are paying taxes to keep this government up and running. Are deprived by the ability to go to the library and read whatever they want to do. So it's
one of the great ironies, I think, in modern political discourse is the insistence of calling a lot of these people public servants. Mm-hmm. But in fact, they're not really servants. But like you said, they're taking tax money and they're providing things that the average people that pay for them cannot even enjoy anymore.
Yes, it is another good example of newspeak, when the Ministry of War is called Ministry of Peace, and the Ministry of Death is called Ministry of Love. So that's exactly what it is. It's just they call themselves public servants. However, they are public masters.
Very good. Well, Dr. Maltsev, one other thing that I was curious to get your thoughts on. Related to the idea of rule of law, in this country we see a lot the prevalence of what we call crony capitalism, mm-hmm. which is when the government gives special favors to certain corporations or political allies. And this is perhaps not something that can be seen as much in the Soviet Union because of the absence of markets, but maybe more so in modern Russia or in other states that still have a lot of remnants of socialism in them.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, that fascist economy is based on crony capitalist foundation. Because if you have a big government who is ruling economy, then you pick up winners and you condemn losers and you create a monopoly state and monopoly supplies and everything like that. And then you create a lot of clients who are dependent on you and you are becoming dependent on them because of their political donations and the political support and things like that. For example, I was just reading a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There's an article one person is demanding that the village of Menominee Falls, I think in Wisconsin, should provide him millions of dollars to build more housing. And he was promised to, but now because of this budget, so-called budget crisis, so they kind of withdrew his their support. But can you imagine the government is providing millions of dollars, both from local and federal taxes, to build more housing? This is insane. This is insane. We have a glut of housing. We have that would undermine even more. We'll have more foreclosures if they will be building more housing. More people would go into underwater mortgages, would walk away from their house. It is such a misguided policy, and some people would think, oh, they're stupid. I would say they're not stupid. They're evil, because crony capitalism is based on profiteering from the big state. Instead of competing with competitors in the market, you just go and bribe politicians. And that's exactly what we see, more and more of that we see in here. In Russia, they had period of crony capitalism was rampant in the 1990s. Now they have KGB back in power, and so KGB does not want to lose monopoly on power. So they put the so-called oligarchs in check, and those who didn't like that, they're in jail, like Mikhail Khodorkovsky, or, you know, the richest man in Russia is right now rotting in the East Siberian jail with them, with roaches and rats. And so it's the governments all over the world, they create the clients, the class which would support them. In some societies, this is in check, and in some societies, it's getting out of this. And today, with the government planning problem, with the government central planning from Washington, D.C., for example, speed rail systems or new environmental batteries or electric cars or whatever else, then definitely the contracts and aid will go to those people who would support these projects.
Very good. Well, Dr. Maltsev, we're going to take our final commercial break here. But when we return from the break, we will be talking about Dr. Maltsev's paper and comparing the formulas of Soviet slavery and of true freedom. This is Radio Free Market, and we'll be back after the break. Everyone, stay with us. All right, everyone, welcome back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm Chris Opperman sitting in for Michael McKay. Dr. Maltsev, as we're wrapping up the show, I guess one of the things that's apparent from the title of your paper is, at the end of the day, the Soviet Union collapsed. Communism and socialism failed. So my question for you is, having seen the Soviet Union, having seen the fall of the Soviet Union, having seen the different countries that came out of the Soviet Union, what do you think is the most important lesson that Americans can learn from the collapse of socialism?
Yes, I believe that it's not only negative, lesson that we should or not to go that way, but there is also a positive lesson, because some of these countries, they have chosen freedom, they have chosen economic freedom and human liberty, and they are doing extremely well. So it is kind of like a real-world experiment when countries which were enslaved in the Soviet Union went there different ways, and those who went in the direction of freedom, they progressed way more than anybody else. I'm talking, for example, about Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, which are star performers in that part of the world, the same as Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovenia. These countries are doing extremely well. And the countries which still are practicing socialism, like Belarus, for example, like Russia itself to some extent, like the Central Asian countries or Moldova, these countries are poor and decimated economies. In Russia, for example, many people think Russia is very wealthy. It's wealthy only in Moscow. Moscow, St. Petersburg, this is a kind of show windows for Russia. But if you will drive 20 minutes outside of downtown Moscow, you will see already a 19th century type of arrangement for peasants.
I'm sure that in Moscow it makes a big difference if you are connected and plugged into the system.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's a system. I would say that's a kind of a state monopoly on looting. And then they can, if there are some private looters that they like, they can give it a piece of the pie. But, for example, Estonia, which was one of the first to declare its independence from Soviet Union, or Georgia, or Lithuania. They embraced property rights right away. They privatized almost everything they could, and today we see that human freedom and economic success is evident in these countries. All Soviet countries had more or less the same standard of living, which was below $2,000 per year under Soviet socialism. When they got their independence, today in Estonia it's almost $30,000 per year per person. In Lithuania, $20,000. However, in Belarus it's about $1,000. In Central Asian republics it's below $1,000. So you can see that the more freedom you have, and that's the major lesson which I think first was taught to us by Adam Smith, that the only source of wealth, of prosperity, is freedom and nothing else. That's, we talk about curse of natural resources, for example. A lot of countries which are endowed with a lot of natural resources, but dirt poor. Look at many Arab countries. Look at Venezuela or Nigeria or Russia itself. None of these natural resources help these people to live prosperously and free. However, you see countries like, again, Estonia or Poland or Czech Republic with no natural resources, and they are doing extremely well today.
Well,
so that, I think...
That's the ultimate lesson, then, the magic of the market and the blessings of human freedom.
Yes, absolutely. Only free people can be productive, and that's what we sometimes would not think that way.
Well, very good. Well, Dr. Maltsev, thank you very, very much for being with us today. You know, your professional and personal insights are of great value to all of our listeners. Thank you so much,
and God bless you. I think that this is a very important role that the Radio Free Market is today playing in the struggle for defending our liberties.
Well, we're doing our best. So, again, thank you to Dr. Maltsev for being with us today. This is Chris Opperman sitting in for Michael McKay on Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes, or visit our Radio Free Market archives for easy downloads. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom, and thank you for listening.